It's very strange speaking in this hall. The last 50 or so times I've been in this room, I've been playing table tennis as well. And in fact, I was here on Friday evening playing table tennis. And I did actually think on Friday, I wonder which was the more effective sermon, how I played table tennis on Friday or how I speak on a Sunday morning. Because everything we do can be done to God's glory. And it ought to infect the whole of our lives. It means obviously playing scrupulously, honestly, with integrity. But it doesn't stop the passion. I think even Mike and Mandy might have heard when I finally beat someone that's beaten me for the last 2 or 3 years. And I won 3-2. And yes. But it did also occur to me that everybody who I was playing with there won't be here this morning. The only sermon they will hear was the one that I was doing while playing table tennis on Friday. So anyway, that could miss a sermon in itself, but we're not going there. We're going to look at a psalm. You've already had one verse from the Psalms this morning. What was it? 119, verse 105. And then what was it? Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. See, they still know it. If you turn to Psalm 139, though, just a little bit further on, I'll read it right through to begin with, for those who like the big picture, and then we'll go through it at walking pace. So this is Psalm 139, for the director of music, little note, which we don't really know what that means, of David, a psalm. O Lord, you have searched me, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. You hem me in, behind and before. You've laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. If only you would slay the wicked, O God. Away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me, and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Okay, it has 24 verses. Some of you might have noticed that there are 4 sections of 6 verses each. And some people look at this psalm and they think, well, the first section is all about God's knowledge of everything. The theological word is omniscience, but you don't have to worry too much about that. He knows everything. Secondly, verses 7 to 12, about God's omnipresence. He's everywhere. You can't get away from him. Then thirdly, about his omnipotence. He can even create the baby in the womb. He can do anything. He's all-powerful. And then about God's holiness at the end. And so they read it as if David were a sort of systematic theologian. Actually, I don't think David was very systematic. He was probably a theologian, but an unsystematic one like the rest of us. And I don't think he was trying to give information about different attributes of God in this psalm. They come in as a sort of side door, but that wasn't really the purpose of it. I think he's describing a journey. Perhaps this is like almost like journal notes about something that he's wrestling with in his thinking. A lot of psalms begin with a problem or an anxiety that the psalmist is facing, a dilemma. Something doesn't fit. There's some clash between what they expect to happen in the world and what is actually happening. And I think we can all share sometimes their experience like that. But what they do is to write it down and to wrestle with it and to see what God is ultimately saying into it and eventually get to a point where they can understand God's purposes at a bigger level, and they can fit in what's happening into a bigger picture of God. And I think that's what's going on in this psalm here. So let's join David on his journey. Like a lot of journeys, if you go for a sort of walk in the countryside, you come back to the starting point. You might have seen all sorts of things on your journey, but nearly always you come back to the point that you began. And David does this. In verse 1, he says, "You have searched me and you know me." And in verse 23, he says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart." Same sort of idea at the beginning and at the end, but it looks like it's in the wrong order. In verse 23, he is asking God to do something that in verse 1, he is saying that God has already done. Doesn't that strike you as being slightly odd? It's not just straightforward. What's going on? Well, I think David is struggling at the beginning with a sense of anxiety. We don't know the situation when he wrote the psalm. It doesn't explain it to us. But I think he's a little bit anxious about God. And perhaps, actually, all of us have times when we can feel a little bit like that, somewhat anxious about who God is, about what his plans are for us, about even his character. Do we feel quite safe? Do we feel, or do we sense a sort of feeling of threat? Are we anxious about certain things in our faith? Sometimes we might think, we want something, or therefore God probably doesn't want it for us. Have you thought that? Why? Is that because you're anxious about God's purposes to bless you or his desires for you? I think if we were less anxious about God, we would be a lot less anxious about lots of other things in life. I'm really good at being anxious about things. Sometimes they can be sort of things that maybe ought to be anxious about. I do remember going down the M5 in one of its phases where they were doing lots of roadworks up near Birmingham. They're still doing it, aren't they? It's a pain. But I was coming down, and at this particular point, it narrowed to one lane with concrete blocks on either side. And I wasn't feeling very well. So I was going along this. It said for 5 miles, it was like this. And a great big lorry was behind me, headlights about, you know, it felt like about 2 feet from the back of the car. It was probably a bit further. And I suddenly had a mounting anxiety and a sort of mild panic attack. And I was thinking, if something goes wrong now, you know, there's not much I can do to get out of the way here. I struggled through in the end. But it was a real sense of panic. And actually, because I was on my own in the car, I got to the point where I was shouting out to God to keep me calm enough to get through these roadworks. So, yeah, I can understand anxiety. And David is anxious. Let's just go through the first few verses. Lord, you have searched me and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts or my intentions from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. And then here comes the rub. You hem me in behind and before. You've laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too, well, the NIV translates wonderful or extraordinary for me. Too lofty for me to attain. All these verses are about God. You have searched me. You know me. You know. You deceive. You discern. You are familiar. It's all you, 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 you. This is all about what kind of God. And he feels, yeah, God knows everything. But is that good news or bad news? Sometimes to know that God knows everything is amazingly comforting and reassuring. He knows, you know, if we've been misjudged by somebody else, he knows what was on our heart. He knows our intentions, even if they actually didn't work out and they might have made a situation worse and everybody's blaming you. But he knows what was on your heart. He knows the battles, the struggles, the temptations that we have in the depths of our souls and hearts. He knows our weaknesses. He knows when we've been misjudged. He knows the damage done to us in the past, which affects our ability to be truly human in our lives. He knows all of that, and all of that is taken into account. And it can be really comforting to know that God knows us at that level, which other people cannot perceive. But it can be threatening as well. It can be quite scary. He knows when our intentions haven't been as pure as we hoped other people would think. He knows things about us which we would rather we kept secret. Psalm 90 verse 8 says, "You've set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence." Yeah, he knows all of those secret sins as well that nobody else knows about. And it's not just that he knows those things. He knows that fallen short, even when we don't realize it. Jeremiah says, "The heart is deceitful above all things. Who can understand it? But I, the Lord, search the heart." He can get inside our hearts. Paul, in 1 Corinthians, says, "My conscience is clear, but that doesn't make me innocent. It's the Lord who judges me." And he might see something that we don't see. He says, "He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of men's hearts." So the fact that God knows us completely is a bit of a two-edged sword. And the psalmist is beginning to feel paralyzed by this. "You hem me in." He doesn't have room to feel free in his faith and his life. "You've laid your hand upon me." Again, what sort of hand is it? Poetry is often quite ambiguous, and it just leaves you with an image, and you have to interpret it really for yourself. Is it the encouraging hand of a coach on an athlete? "Well done, go for it." Is it the hand of a policeman on a criminal? Is it the hand of a father on a disobedient child? Like in Psalm 38, "Your arrows have sunk into me, your hand has come down on me." It feels like he's being smacked or something. Is it a hand protecting him or a hand dragging him out of a corner? Interesting. Think, visualize God's hand in terms of your life. What is it doing? And we're not told in this psalm what exactly was in David's mind. But all of this is too extraordinary for him. It's too much for him to cope with. The fact that God knows everything about him is suddenly leaving him really quite anxious. And so what does he decide to do? He wants to run away. Not the first person to feel like that when they encounter God. Judah, after selling his brother into slavery, just goes away from his family for the next 20 years. Elijah flees into the desert. Jonah gets on a ship and goes to Tarshish. So they all try to flee from God. David doesn't flee literally, but he flees in his imagination. He sees, "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence?" I think there's something going on. The fact that he wants to flee from God's presence. He's saying, "Where can I go? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, in Sheol, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast." I'll come back to that verse. "If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you." Those verses 1 to 6 were all about you, you, you. This is all about I. if I do this, if I do that, if I do that, if I go here, if I flee there, I still can't escape from you. So he's going to wrestle with this issue. How does this I that wants to escape wrestle with this you that knows everything? But again, knowing that God is everywhere is also a two-edged sword, isn't it? It means that we can't escape him. In Amos 9, there's a passage where God is speaking to the people. Though they dig down to the depths of the grave, from there my hand will take them. Though they climb up to the heavens, from there I will bring them down. Though they hide themselves on the top of Carmel, there I will hunt them down and seize them. Though they hide from me at the bottom of the sea, there I will command the serpent to bite them. Though they're driven into exile by their enemies, there I will command the sword to slay them. I will fix my eyes upon them for evil and not for good. If you're running away from God, it's not good news that you can't do it. There's nowhere that you can go that God can't find you. But you might think, well, verse 10, it's very positive. Even there, your hand will guide me. Actually, this is a little bit more ambiguous as well. It actually says, your hand will lead me. The NIV sometimes is quite generous in its translation. In Job, the same verb is used. He makes nations great and destroys them. He enlarges nations and he leads them away into exile. Even there, your hand is going to be upon me. You can still move me. Your hand is still taking hold of me. It's a bit like a chess piece on a board. Has nowhere to hide if you're the queen on the chess piece. It doesn't matter if you go the other side of the board or to the left or to the right. You can't get away from the chess player who can pick you up and move you wherever they want to go. That's what David is finding really quite scary. All of this reflection on his anxiety has made it worse. He's face to face with a God that knows everything about him and he can't escape. So where do you go from there? And that's often the question in life. There's a moment of encounter often with God at certain stages in life where God closes in on somebody. C.S. Lewis, in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, the chapter in which he is converted, finally, is called Checkmate. And I think the previous chapter was called Check for Memory. It's as if God is constantly battling C.S. Lewis, in that case, into a corner where he can't escape this encounter with him. Sheldon Van Orken wrote a book called A Severe Mercy. Has anybody read this? Oh, you should do. It's a good book. Page 98, if I find it, it describes his encounter with God, his moment where he feels that he's blocked into a situation. One day there came the next intellectual breakthrough. It was the chilling realization that I could not go back. In my old easygoing theism, I'd regarded Christianity as a sort of fairy tale, and I'd neither accepted nor rejected Jesus, since I had never, in fact, encountered him. Now I had. The position was not, as I'd been comfortably thinking all these months, merely a question of whether I was to accept the Messiah or not. It was a question of whether I was to accept him or reject. There was a gap behind me, too. Perhaps the leap to acceptance was a horrifying gamble, but what of the leap to rejection? There might be no certainty that Christ was God, but by God, there was no certainty that he wasn't. If I were to accept, I might and probably would face the thought through the years, perhaps after all, it's a lie I've been had. But if I were to reject, I would certainly face the haunting, terrible thought, perhaps it's true, and I have rejected my God. This was not to be borne. I could not reject Jesus. There was only one thing for me to do once I'd seen the gap behind me. I turned away from it and flung myself over the gap towards Jesus. That was his moment of encounter. And he actually wrote another book called Encounter with Light, that experience of God blocking him into a corner where all he could do was to turn to God and come before him. Another example, I was reminded, those of you who at a certain age might have known Francis Thompson's poem, The Hound of Heaven. Anybody read that? It's a book, again, that's very well read, some of you over there. 19th century poet who describes God as being like a hound, a dog, pursuing him. And he's trying to get away, and he just can't get away. He says, I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind. And in the midst of tears, I hid from him, and under running laughter. Up vistaed hoops I sped, and shod precipitated down titanic looms of chasmed fears. From those strong feet that followed after. But with unhurrying chase and unperturbed grace, deliberate speed, majestic instancy, they beat, and a voice beats more instant than the feet. All things betray thee who betrayest me. The poem is much longer than that, and it just carries on about how eventually God pursues him like a faithful dog pursuing somebody until finally he backs into the corner and has to accept him. So the psalmist here has to come to terms with his understanding of God. It'd be nice to know how long it was in writing this psalm. Sometimes I think we imagine that the psalmist wrote down with a blank sheet of paper and wrote down a psalm from A to Z in a single sitting at the desk or whatever it was on his papyrus. I suspect it wasn't like that. I suspect there might have been weeks between some of the verses in the Psalms where he's wrestling with the issues. And he comes back and then has to think through. And he's finally, I can write another verse. I certainly don't think he wrote Psalm 119 in a single sitting. And anybody that writes creatively knows that you get writer's block at times, or you think, where do I go from here? How do I pursue this? I read about Tolkien when he wrote Lord of the Rings. He says, when the hobbits got to Bree, he said, and Gandalf wasn't there, he said, I didn't know why Gandalf wasn't there either. and it took him a year before he got back to the story when he knew how to carry on. And maybe some of the Psalms are like that. They write down the problems and they're wrestling with it and thinking, how can I fit? And then he has this kind of moment where he can carry on. He knows he can't hide from God, as it were, in space, wherever he goes. And he thinks about time. And he thinks about the beginning of all things, or at least the beginning of his own existence. And he knows that this God that he is encountering, was there right at the beginning. The relationship between them isn't something that's just beginning. It's something from God's side was there right from the beginning of his own existence. This God was his creator. This God brought him into being. He molded him with care, like a sculptor bringing to birth a living work of art. He was held by God in the womb and embroidered, as it were, knit together in the womb for God's good purposes, and he was brought into existence to further those purposes. God wasn't bringing him into existence like an experimental rat or something to try different things on. He brought him into existence to bless him. One commentator describes it, you've set my destiny within your purpose. You've set the destiny that you have for me as a person within God's overarching purposes. God doesn't bring people into being to play with them or to destroy them, but to bless them and to bless others through them. And God's knowledge of us is not a knowledge that is going to destroy us. Even when he brings to light a hidden sin or a secret sin, it's like a surgeon bringing to light a cancer. It's to get rid of it. It's not the magistrate bringing to light another crime in order to impose a heavier sentence. God isn't like that. It's to get rid of it and get cleansed of it and move you forward. What he actually writes is, for you created, verse 13, you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, Do you know, that's the first time in the psalm he said, I praise you. All the other things have been statements. But now he can begin to worship. Now he's beginning to reflect on the heart of God. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful, I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. I once read in a Reader's Digest, you know they have those little quotes at the bottom of articles, and it said, you wouldn't worry about what other people thought of you if you knew how little they did. But that's not true of God. If you go to the seaside, pick up a grain of sand and think, that represents one time that God has thought about me, and then pick up the next grain of sand, and then go through the whole beach and pick up every single grain. You can't do it. God has thought about you more often than there are grains of sand on the beach. He's never stopped thinking about you. His plans, he doesn't just sort of switch off for a year or two and then say, oh, yes, there you go. He thinks about you constantly. He thought about you before you were born, before the creation of the world in some mysterious way that I certainly don't understand. But you are dear to him, and he is wanting to bless you and to think about how your life can fit within his purposes for your best good as well. And this means that the fact that God knows all about him can again be a comfort to him. You've got the most skilled surgeon in the world operating on your diseased soul, as it were, working out how to bring you to a place of total holiness and ultimately perfection, but that won't happen in this life. But, you know, we can work on it. Because he's seen something of the heart of God, he can then reflect on the attributes of God as well. God's knowledge, God's presence, and the fact that God is seeking to heal him. But the psalm doesn't end there. I did hear a sermon on this psalm a few months ago, and characteristically it finished at that point because the last few verses are a less comfortable reading. But the psalmist realizes it's not just God and me. It's God, me, and I'm part of a community as well. And I might be within God's purposes to try to seek God, but there's others in the community that maybe aren't. How do we relate to those? How is it that God's purposes aren't being fulfilled in our community around us? The psalmist lies the other side of the cross. We might want to pray for conversion for those who appear to be doing quite destructive things in the world. But he is at least passionate about hating evil. He's passionate about his community, the impact of evil on his community, which he wants to reduce. He wants God to do something about it. He wants God to remove evil from his creation, which is a hope which we also share, because one day God will do that. But he does, in typical psalmist language, if only you would slay the wicked, the faithless ones, O God, away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name, hence breaking the third commandment. Do not misuse the name of the Lord your God. Don't I hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I've got nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. But it might be he just sits and reflects for a second about that. He might have thought about the proverb, if you point one finger at somebody else, you have three fingers pointing back at you. Because he suddenly thinks, well, maybe I've got things that need to be sorted out by God. If I want God to remove evil from creation, then I need him to remove it from me. And he says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. He's aware of his anxious thoughts. They're still there, but he wants God to open them up, as it were. See if there is any offensive way in me. Lead me in the way everlasting, or the ancient way. He wants God, as it were, to take an x-ray of his soul and see things that are hidden and to do something about them. He's now, instead of God searching him, being a threat, now he invites God to search him. He wants God to do that for him. Like you would want to ask a doctor, search me and see if there's anything wrong with me, so that things can be done about it. I'm just going to finish with a poem which reflects some of the themes of the psalm. It's written this side of the cross, so it has the example of Jesus as well. The poem is called Triptych. And a triptych, if you know about art, a triptych is when you have an altar and you have three panels of art above the altar. The central one is often a crucifixion or something like that. Then two panels either side, looking in, as it were. So in this poem, Triptych, the first stanza is somebody complaining to God. And then the second two are God's response to him, or in imagining what Jesus would say to him in response. And it does pick up the themes of the psalm in certain places. I did not choose to be born, to be torn from the womb, to be trapped like a rat in a tomb. I did not sign on the line for this life of mine, to be cast adrift with this unwanted gift on the currents of space and time. I did not choose to be born, to mourn in a world where every wall might totter and fall, where bears might attack if you step on a crack and every bird be slain with a word, where might conquers right and every light will slowly fade into a darker shade of night. I did not choose to be born, to be left forlorn, to play in a game without knowing its name or its rules. Just why was there a dawn to greet the day that I was born? For I did not choose. But I did. I chose to be born. I left behind eternity. I chose the womb and the road to the tomb. I chose to be wrapped in swaddling bands, to be held and loved by human hands, and to be nailed to a tree. I chose to be born, to endure the scorn, to weep, to mourn, to be left forlorn. I chose my life, the years of tears, the strife, the war. I knew the law and the story. I chose my death. I knew the trap. I knew whose jaws were behind those doors. I knew the loss upon the cross and the glory. I knew the name of the game and the pain and the shame, and still I came, for I chose to be born. And I chose for you to be born. I made the choice for you to be formed from the breath of my voice. You are mine. I framed your face. I gave you birth in time and space. I shaped your heart to know my grace. I took a chance and left you free, hoping you'll come home with me to join the dance between the three. And one day I will take your shame and gently whisper your true name, and then you'll understand the game. No evil lies beyond my sight. The darkness will be turned to light, and all the earth will be put right. So do not fear when you are torn. Do not fear when you must mourn. For I am the light of the final dawn, and it was I who desired that you should be born. Amen.